I would definitely probably use Android Studio if I was doing a lot of Java.
Yeah, I'm a big Android Studio fan. I actually have a Vim plugin for inside Android Studio, but it makes it really difficult when I try to use Vim outside of Android Studio because I like have mixed the like IntelliJ key bindings with some of the Vim like key bindings to like optimize my workflow. But then I try and like I have auto formatting. So I'll like be in a Vim terminal and like try and auto format and like nothing happens.
Yeah, that can make things difficult.
Yeah. Also makes pairing with any like regular Vim user really weird because they're like, it's like Vim, but it's drunk. I'm like, exactly, that's Android development.
Hi, Amanda.
Hey, Sean.
So Derek and Layla are both out this week. Do you want to introduce yourself for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. My name is Amanda. I work with Layla in the San Francisco Thoughtbot office as an Android developer.
Okay, so actually, I've got a question for you because I overheard a conversation. So at Shopify, the team that I do open source full time.
Gotcha.
But I technically fall under a team here called Dev Acceleration, which is sort of like we build all of the internal tools.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a tool called Dev, which is our kind of general, like, get in your environment running, do sandboxing, run tests, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was recently a big push to make it work with things other than just Rails projects. Okay. And so mobile was the biggest part of that. And I was overhearing, as part of the getting it working with Android, I was overhearing a conversation. It sounded like ADB has been, like, deprecated, and all of the command line tools have been deprecated in favor of Android Studio.
Oh, that is news to me. I definitely still use ADB. I think they've possibly integrated them better.
Okay.
I think in the latest Android Studio update that's still in Canary or some other Raven Bird channel, I think that has support for like your own aliases in the terminal inside Android Studio.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that's what the update was. I could be wrong, but I definitely still use ADB. I think the hardest problem with Android setup is that order matters. So you really have to install Java first and then Android Studio. And if you don't do it in that order, you end up really unhappy because the system, Android Studio, tries to be very clever and find it and find what version. If you don't have it, it makes assumptions. And then if you download a different version, you're in this weird, miserable place.
Right. I know it's interesting comparing the approaches that Google and Apple took when it comes to just development environments and like the development flow in general, right? Because Android Studio for the longest time wasn't even a thing.
Right.
And it was just sort of like you had ADB
and Eclipse.
And yeah, a lot of people used Eclipse. And like there was kind of sort of the general things that most people used in terms of Ant. Well, I mean, Ant was the only officially supported way, and then people like hacked into Maven. But like before they switched to the Gradle build system and introduced Android Studio, it was all very ad hoc. But there was a lot of existing tooling that could be leveraged on, even if it didn't work together quite as well.
Yep.
It's just interesting contrasting that to the iOS approach, right? Where it's like they have the platform and the language and the IDE, although you would think the IDE should never crash.
Yes.
Given how much control they have over it, and it still doesn't quite work properly. But it's always been an interesting just contrast looking at the differences between the two and the approaches that they took.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that with Xcode as well, like, I think tooling is really hard. And so I actually do respect Google a lot for kind of opting to kind of piggyback off IntelliJ for Android Studio, because that is just a very well-established working IDE that people have been using for a very long time. So rather than reinvent the wheel, kind of just being like, this works. I mean, they did the same thing with Java, I guess, but I definitely respect the kind of we need it to work approach, and we're not as egomaniacal and obsessed with owning things end to end.
Right.
Which is kind of nice.
Well, also, and it, you know, for any listeners who aren't familiar with what we're talking about, IntelliJ is a Java IDE made by JetBrains. They make lots of IDEs. RubyMine is one that's probably the most well-known among Rubyists, and then Android Studio is the IDE that Google released that is built off of the open... Is the Community Edition open source?
I actually
don't... Or did they just get the source code?
I'm not sure. I think it might be open source. Knowing JetBrains, it might be.
Regardless of if it's open source or not, there's the paid edition, the Community Edition, and Android Studio was a fork of the IntelliJ Community Edition to make it more Android specific and added things like a previewer that is a previewer for UIs and better knowledge of like XML stuff that Android does and other things as well. But at least in the original version, those were the big changes.
Yeah, those are the big kind of components.
So yeah, that's what Android Studio is for any listeners who are unfamiliar with it, since I don't know if we've talked too much about Android, so I'm not sure how many Android devs we'll have listening, but because the last time we were talking about Android was when I was on the AR project, and that was mostly C, so it wasn't even really Android.
Yeah, it's interesting, like meeting other developers. It's really easy for them. I find that a lot of people have interest in iOS now because of Swift, and they find that language really exciting. But then if you were a computer science major in college or you have any sort of formal computer science degree, you either wrote in C or Java when you first started learning. So they're like, oh, yeah, I could, you know, read some of that code. And it reminds them of when they were 18 and like kind of cracked out in college. So it's always kind of funny to explain to people that I'm now an adult and I choose Java. I don't really choose it as much as it's forced upon me, but
well,
people can relate.
Right. So back when I was doing like, quote unquote, real Android, I was sort of a big proponent of Scala for Android.
Mm-hmm.
And this was sort of this was before Swift got announced, and then it started getting a bigger following actually right after Swift got announced. And a lot of people were talking about, could Scala potentially be Android's answer to Swift? Because Scala was one of the largest influences on Swift as a language.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like since then Kotlin, because Kotlin wasn't really a thing back then when I was big into Scala.
Yeah.
And it seems like Kotlin has gained some traction, and it definitely is a language that, if you're going to be heavily interacting with Java, especially in an inheritance-based API like Android is when it comes to creating your own activities or fragments, it seems like it might be a much better fit.
Yeah.
Have you seen much adoption of Kotlin in Android, and do you think it could eventually kind of fill a similar-ish role?
Yeah, definitely. I'm actually currently writing an app right now in Kotlin. We have a internal Tropos, or I guess it's out in the wild for iOS, and we're working on the Android version in both Java and Kotlin. I definitely think it's being adopted. A lot of open source projects now will have a Kotlin version and a Java version. I think because of all the reasons, it's a lot more attractive. It's a lot less verbose than Java. It solves a lot of the problems and limitations with the Java language. Additionally, not even with Java, but with Android, for people who don't know Android development, Android is almost always at least 1 year behind the most recent Java version. So I think they just announced, I don't know if it's released yet, Java 9. And Android development is basically on 6.5-ish. They've pulled over some features of Java 7, but it's not completely not taking advantage of everything in Java 7, let alone Java 8. So even though the language is changing and growing and we're getting all these features in Java 8, they introduced streams so you can actually like iterate over collections nicely.
Right. And anonymous functions that are less than 6 lines.
Exactly. As an Android developer, you don't even have access to that. So Kotlin solves a lot of that by being a functional language that does compile down to the JVM. So you end up with bytecode at the end, which is why it's so interoperable. It's a lot more lightweight than Scala, which is really nice.
Right, well, because the biggest issue with Scala was always, because Android, at least on Dalvik, and it seems to have been more or less fixed now by, I don't remember the name of the new VM.
I think it is still, things are still don't compile down to Dalvik. There's the Jack and Jill compiler now.
Is it just the AOT compilation stuff?
Yeah.
Well, there are two things that made it a lot easier in 5, I think, which was the generational garbage collector, because 4 and earlier have a garbage collector that makes like old versions of Ruby's garbage collector look like it's top of the line. Right. But then the other thing is there's a method limit on, because they compile your entire, rather than having the individual class files that get packaged up as a jar, on Android, everything gets compiled into a single DEX file, and that needs to represent your entire application.
Yep.
And there's an arbitrary limit there of
67,000.
Yeah, short max val.
Yeah.
65,775, yep. I believe it's the, it's yeah. 2 to the 16th.
Yeah.
And the Scala standard library is significantly larger than that in terms of number of overall functions, because Scala has a tendency to create a lot of like just anonymous objects that have 6 or 7 methods on each of them. And so you had to introduce, you were introducing tooling that most people would introduce anyway in order to strip out unused methods and lower your overall APK size. But that was a big pain back then.
Yeah.
So that's for those who are unfamiliar with Android, that was why Scala was sometimes painful and why
Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, on the Kotlin like language website, there's a whole section in the FAQ about like its comparison to Scala, because I think so many people have that question when kind of exploring it as a language. It's also kind of interesting to note that Kotlin was developed by JetBrains, and they kind of developed the language and have immediately and intentionally started pushing it towards Android development, because they think that's kind of the biggest sell. I went to an Android conference back in March, and there was a bunch of talks on Kotlin, and the most popular question was always, does anyone have an example of an app that we would all know about that's in the Play Store that uses like 100% Kotlin? And it seemed like at that time the answer was no, but a lot of people had started writing their tests in Kotlin, because that was a really easy way for developers to kind of play with the language without having to convince anyone on the product side that we're like doing something crazy and experimental, but also get to really use it. I think at this point now, based on just Twitter, a lot more people are kind of starting to slowly integrate it into their apps and either new features or kind of slowly building it up. So I'm going to another conference in September, and I'm curious to see at that point kind of the general feeling of how many people are using it.
Yeah. Like, I think a lot of the issue with Scala wasn't so much problems with the language, but with the community that grew out of it.
Interesting. And the Android community or the Scala side?
The Scala side, definitely. The Scala Android community, there were dozens of us. Dozens! I was a big proponent of it, and I was thinking, and you know what? I think if I had been able to put more energy, if some other people had put some energy into it, it could have grown. But yeah. That clearly did not happen.
Yeah.
So, I don't recall. Does Kotlin have overloadable operators? Like arbitrary overloadable operators?
Off the top of my head, I don't know.
Because that was a thing that's a thing that Swift has. And yeah. It's a thing that Scala had.
Mm-hmm.
And because Scala sort of had the functional roots, and this is a problem of that I have with Haskell as well. Like, when you have arbitrary overloadable operators and people go crazy with them.
Right.
Like, so many things in Scala would define the operator tilde greater than, so a squiggly arrow.
Yep.
It's like, okay, what does that do?
Yep.
You can't Google that.
No. Yeah. We have this, ThoughtBot has a project called Runes, and it's the Swift operator library, and I've been trying to kind of dabble in iOS a little bit more, and reading a lot of that code is, it, like, hurts your brain, and the best argument I've heard from it so far is someone kind of said, when you look at a plus sign, you know what it means, and actually that is better than words. You know, you could write the word plus, but if you see a plus sign, you know exactly what's happening, so you don't have to think about it. So theoretically, once you knew what all these symbols meant, it should be just as simple. I just think,
right.
Personally,
that's assuming like an unlimited right. cognitive capacity to learn new symbols.
Exactly.
Like plus is different because every language has plus.
Right. Exactly. It was just.
Please do not comment on this episode with all of the languages that don't have plus. By the way, that was
no.
I know not all languages actually have plus. Thank you. Sorry.
It was just the closest argument that I ever heard to. It was the first argument I'd heard that made me go, okay, maybe you're not all as insane as it would appear you are by just reading the README for this library.
Right. I really liked Rust's approach, because it seems like for most languages, it's either you have overloadable operators.
Mm-hmm.
Like, most languages either allow arbitrary overloadable operators, or they do not allow overloading of operators at all.
Yeah.
Whereas Rust allows you to overload. I think actually Ruby is almost in the same place as well, where it's like, here's the predefined set of overloadable operators, and you can overload those operators.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's a lot cleaner, too.
Because, like, it's always annoying when you switch something to use BigInteger in Java,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden, like, oh, I can't use plus anymore.
Yeah. It is nice for nullness. That's, like, the only case that I've ever really found it, like, valuable for. Especially with, there's an Android library called Retrofit, that Square owns, or releases. It's an open source library for, it's an HTTP client. Mm-hmm. And, for query parameters, if you pass null, it just doesn't add the query parameter, which is super helpful. But for pagination, it's really common to have, you know, from or to pages or size limits. And so if you used a regular int, the compiler won't let you pass null, and then it'll add this like query parameter of nothing, or it won't even compile. So to be able to use BigInteger and pass null for this one particular use case is like nice.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's fine. I just want to be able to use a plus operator with it.
Yeah.
And not dot plus.
Or dot equals for string.
Right.
Seems like they could have fixed that.
That's not a thing anymore, though, right? Equals equals does call dot equals, I thought. Or am I just completely wrong? I've been writing incredibly incorrect Java.
I've never switched. It's possible they updated it, but out of habit, I definitely still write dot equals.
I'm pretty sure they changed it to, so that equals equals does use the dot equals method, like in Java 5.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
I could be completely wrong.
Yeah, no.
But
someone comment and let us know, since we just can't Google.
Yeah. So this came up recently on one of the Rust user groups. So quality in Rust, the way it works is you implement this trait called EQ.
Mm-hmm.
And a trait's basically like an interface. Like, have you done Scala or Haskell ever?
No.
So it's basically like an interface, but you implement it separately from the type itself.
Okay.
So you wouldn't do, like, class foo implements bar.
Got
you'd
it.
Do class foo, and then later on you'd say, here's the implementation of bar for foo.
Got it.
And you define the EQ method, and then there's the NE method, which has a default implementation.
Okay.
So we have values and references.
Mm-hmm.
But the EQ trait is implemented for references as dereference and check if the values are equal. So, like, there's no actual form of reference equality by default in Rust.
Interesting.
And I've been thinking about this, like, in Ruby, and this is true in Java, right? Because the signature of equals takes object.
Right.
Which I've always found a little bit confounding, because, like, I kind of prefer it to fail to compile if I'm comparing two things for equality if they can never be equal.
Yeah, I think the contract there is more, like, it's concerned about, like, equals and hash code. And so, like, if those two match up, then you're fine. But even so, it'll compile if they're not. It's just, like, a bad way to write Java code.
Right. And it's a thing that, like, it's a common mistake in Ruby, where, like, yeah, they'll define their own value object.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be some, you know, it'll be basically a struct that has a few fields, but they'll forget to implement equality on it. And the default implementation, like, equality has a default implementation, and it defaults to reference equality.
Yep.
I'm just like, when has that ever been useful?
Yeah. I think a lot of the, like, kind of original computer science laws and programming mentalities made sense a really long time ago when people were really truly writing their own code outside of frameworks. But I think now that so many people are writing either mobile applications or Rails or something that's kind of within a framework, a lot of those original, I'll call it OG kind of concepts don't make as much sense anymore.
Right.
Because it requires that you both, like, understand how the framework is using them, because the writers of the framework have made decisions about how they want to determine equality, and they might be overriding the default implementation in places, and then you might not in your actual code. So it kind of requires you to both know the framework really well, and then also your language, even though, like, in Android, for example, like, Java allows for things, but Android doesn't, so it's a lot of cognitive overload.
Yeah. So I don't know how long ago the API was released, but my phone just got updated with Android 7.
Nice.
So as far as I'm concerned, it just came out, and we're all just seeing it for the first time.
You're only about, like, 2 weeks behind when they, like, officially released it, so.
Right, well, cause, I mean, it's a Nexus, so.
Yeah.
Have you played around with it at all?
I have. I actually just got it a few days ago myself. I don't care for the, so for the listeners who might not know, Android 7 Nougat, which is the worst name, just came out, and one of the big features they allow for is a split window, so to have kind of two apps on the screen at the same time, which for Android development, to me, is just a huge slap in the face. For the longest time in Android, what you saw on the screen in an app was referred to as an activity, and if you wanted to have two things on the screen at the same time, you'd have to have fragments. So right. The classic example is like a master and a detail view. So like your email client, you'd have a list of emails on the side and the detail on the right. And that was how you handled split screen, admittedly, like within an app. And then, because you couldn't have two activities on the screen at the same time. And then in Nougat, they were like, hey, just kidding. Now you can have two activities on the screen at the same time.
But they can't interact. Like, they're not, as far as either one's concerned, they're just both on a smaller screen, right? They're not able to interact.
They are, actually. You can, like, drag things from one activity to the next.
Oh.
So this whole fragment nonsense that we've all been dealing with for years is now totally moot.
Well, I could see why that might be. Yeah, that might be a little annoying.
Yeah. But other than that, I like it. The updates to notifications are really great. I think everything is a lot clearer. For the longest time, you'd look at notifications, especially around location. There are so many different choices. And as a developer, I even have trouble reading them. It's like, what is the difference between high accuracy, low battery, and, you know, GPS plus Wi-Fi? Like, it's really confusing, and I think they've done a much better job at explaining it to the average user. Like, this is what this selection means in terms of, like, security and battery life. Because I think those are probably people's biggest concerns when it comes to location.
I will say this. iOS has no equivalent of the Fuse location provider.
Yeah.
And I have one app that's on the Play Store that is, like, my own just personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an Android version, or an iOS version, that's, like, completely finished. Its design is way out of date now because I wrote it for iOS 6.
Oh, wow, yeah.
But, like, I've never released it. And every time a new version of iOS comes out, I go, look, like, can I do this without killing my user's battery? Nope.
Nope.
Because it needs to do a very specific type of geofencing that I just, like, unless I want to unless I want to throw four square levels of engineering at it, I'm not going to be able to do that geofencing in a battery-efficient way on iOS. The Fuse location provider is, like, the best thing ever.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings there as well. I think this, something we talk about definitely, like, within the mobile space a lot is you are able to read, we can read Martin Fowler and all these, like, classic mobile and just development architecture patterns, which are all beautiful and great. The problem is when you try and apply them to a mobile framework. And so in Android specifically, a lot of the, anytime you need a Google API client, you don't just get one for free with an app. You actually have to, like, create an instance of a Google API client. And then it has all these callback methods that assume you're using either an activity or a fragment. And it kind of forces you to architect your app in a way that you might not want to. And you can't kind of build a lot of these clean components that handle things in their own decoupled way. And I think that's definitely one of the most frustrating parts about mobile development is being forced to architect an app based on the way that either Android or iOS is forcing you to.
I'm going to be fair, right? So it very closely mirrors issues that people have with Rails apps.
Mm-hmm.
Because an activity in Android is analogous to a controller in Rails.
Got it.
We don't have necessarily the same level. Well, we do actually have the same level of lifecycle methods, but it's a little bit different in that the lifecycle methods are all optional, and you specifically, like, have one method per endpoint.
Got it.
But similar thing. So you never knew up an instance of a controller in Rails.
Yeah.
And you don't necessarily ever... You can't test them outside of the test classes that Rails provides for you.
Gotcha.
But I think the way you end up doing it is somewhat similar in that you just try to pull as much of your logic into something that is not your activity class. And then, if possible, have onCreate just...
Yeah.
Knew that up. And then if you can avoid having to pass context around, because once you pass context around, you're passing the world around.
Yeah.
And for those who are unfamiliar with Android, onCreate is sort of, so you, activity, again, represents sort of a screen, or now half a screen potentially.
Right.
And there are various lifecycle methods that get called, which are basically like when the thing first gets, what is effectively your constructor, but you can't override the constructor because reasons.
Yep.
And then there are lifecycle methods for this thing has been constructed, this thing is on screen but not necessarily in focus, and then this thing has come into focus. Am I remembering those correctly?
Yeah, so it's like if any of you have an Android device, kind of when you would hit the square button, so like you get to pick between all your different apps, so it's like people can still see it. I think, and I'm definitely going to mess this up, but it's something like, so initially it goes on start, on resume, on create, then on pause, on stop, on destroy. And it, mostly a lot of it has to do with, like, can someone see this on your phone right now?
Right.
And yeah, the constructor problem is, I think, to me, one of the most frustrating things because it makes dependency injection miserable.
No, you just use, what's the one that was really hot? I mean, I have no clue if it's still hot. There was one that
Dagger.
Was getting really hot. Yeah, Dagger was getting really hot like 3 years ago.
Yeah, Dagger's still around. They've actually released Dagger 2, which like totally breaks and changes Dagger 1. But there's a lot of overhead there and a lot of reasons why people might not like it or might not use it. It's just, it's miserable. Whatever you end up choosing is pretty miserable.
It's leaps and bounds above using Spring for DI.
Fair, I've never used Spring, but I believe you.
Nothing like having your entire application live in XML configuration files. No, see, because you don't understand. If it's all in XML configuration files, you can completely change the behavior of your application without having to recompile it.
Yep.
Because that's a thing that anybody has ever needed to do, ever.
Yep. God. That is one of the nice things, actually, about Kotlin and one of the reasons that people kind of argue for it. So for typical Android development, for people who don't know, there are three languages that you have to know. Java, obviously, for application code. Layouts are typically written in XML, although a lot of views are possible. You can write them in Java as well. And lastly is Groovy for writing. Gradle is the build tool that Android uses. So it's Groovy, Java, and XML. If you switched over to Kotlin, you could theoretically write everything in Kotlin. So you go from three languages to one. You could still use Gradle, or you could still, or you could still use Groovy, and you could still use XML if you wanted, but it is a replacement. So the kind of context switching that you would do in a given day, or even if you were a new developer who wanted to switch over, it's a lot less languages.
See, this was all the stuff I was saying. Like, this was why Scala was great.
Yeah. So no, that is a really nice feature, actually. So a bunch of us are on book this week in San Francisco, and so we decided to kind of get together and design and build an app in 5 days to kind of proof of concept, see that this works, and this is something that we could do as mobile developers and designers. And we're working on this app that very simply shows you a list of fruits and vegetables and when that fruit or vegetable is in season. Doesn't solve a huge problem, but it really kind of, because of its simplicity, lets us kind of show off our design a little bit more.
Yeah.
So I'm writing the app entirely in Kotlin. And Kotlin, I think the people at JetBrains released this library called Anko. And it's DSL, basically XML replacer. So you could write all of your layouts in Kotlin now, which is really nice. It definitely isn't perfect, and there's a lot of kind of issues with it. The biggest issue for me right now is being able to preview the layout. If you write it in XML, Android Studio allows you to see the layout right next to it, and if you change something, you see it immediately.
Well, and that's the big benefit of a markup language over a programming language.
And so for Kotlin, if you wanted to use it for your views, you have to run every time you want to see a layout change, which if you have a small app, it took only a couple of seconds, but even that couple of seconds over the course of, like, if you're pairing with a designer, you just look like such an idiot. I'm always like, I'm sorry, this is the world that we live in.
I mean, hey, you know what? If it's down to, like, a couple of seconds, by a couple, you mean, like, less than 20, right?
Yeah, less than 20.
I mean, that's leaps and bounds above where it was not that long ago. Is this for emulator or on device?
So this is actually just, like, if in Android Studio. But
it'll actually execute your code.
Yeah. So it is running build every time. Yeah. But compared to XML, which is instant, is a little not ideal.
Sure.
But yeah, no, definitely a lot of fun. There's also, I think there was a lot of support for XML for a long time. And a lot of kind of, there's this whole tools concept. So you can have things only in preview and then not actually have them in the code, which is nice.
Right.
And, Anko does not have that yet. So it's not quite there yet. It's definitely a massive jump in the right direction. But we're not there yet.
This is just reminding me of, I'm trying to remember the name of the API now. It was new in M.
Mm-hmm.
Last time I was doing, like, major Android. It was the general replacement for list view.
Recycler view. Yes.
And it was like you could see why it was going to be way better.
Yep. So.
But kind of really crappy.
Yeah. So.
Did it get better?
It did. It got a lot better. Very fortuitous timing. I actually just released a recycler view library this morning.
Oh.
One of the many problems you get as a mobile developer is a designer coming to you and being like, I really want this web pattern. And you're like, the framework doesn't have it, so I have to build this custom. So this solves the problem of an expandable list. So if you have, you know, think about a bunch of categories and you want to tap one of the categories and have it expand, that's what this library does. So list view was originally the option for showing a collection of data on the screen. There were two components to a list view itself, which extended from this class called adapter view, and a list view took an adapter, which had a bunch of methods, but the big ones were kind of get item view count and this method called get view, which took an integer position from your data list, your backing data set, and created a view. Pretty simple, and that's how they showed it. The problem was it incredibly tightly coupled how the list was displayed with this kind of adapter, which is really responsible for, it's like your traditional MVC kind of controller for taking a set of data and then returning a view.
Right.
So recycler view pulled all the pieces out. There are three components now to get a list on screen. There's the recycler view itself, which is just a view group, which is really just a parent layout. It has children layouts. There's a layout manager, which says how we're going to lay out the views. And an adapter, which now, instead of having, like, I think base adapter has 10 methods, a recycler view adapter has 3.
Right.
So it really, really simplified it. So my favorite example is if you wanted to have a vertical list and then you wanted to switch it to a the list to be horizontal, you just change out the layout manager. So it's literally one line of code. If you want it to be a staggered grid,
right,
you just change out the layout manager. So it really does decouple all the components of how you show a set of data on screen and makes it really, really customizable, which is nice.
So I'm sure there are going to be some people right now who are like, well, why on earth is this so complicated? It's a list. So should we talk about, like, why exactly Recycler View has to recycle?
Yeah, so this is definitely something that mobile developers deal with way more regularly than web developers, and that's state and memory and the fact that you're trying to do everything on this super tiny rectangle. So the other advantage of Recycler View, and the reason they named it accordingly, is for memory allocation. So a typical list, I think, has 8 items on screen. And mm-hmm. so if you had to inflate every view for, let's say you had a store and all of your products, that would get incredibly expensive and waste a lot of memory since the user's only seeing 8 of these like items at a time. But also, you want the actual title to change and things like that. So they're able to kind of reuse the existing view using a view holder pattern and just reassign values to the views that are already on screen.
And a view holder pattern was a best practice that came out of the old list view.
Yeah, exactly. So it's definitely a lot more optimized and a lot better, but definitely with the ability to kind of extend something in quite the way you can with Recycler View, there's a lot of overhead. And just if, for example, you wanted to show a very simple list, if you were like, for this fruits app, for example, it's like, we have 5 fruits we're starting with. To get 5 fruits to show up on screen requires 3 classes and a lot of code.
Right. And right, so the other thing too, because you could recycle with list view. It was just like a not great API, because they passed you the view and it may or may not be null. And if it was null, you had to deal with also creating the new one.
Exactly.
So this app that I have on the Play Store is called Cigar Finder.
Yeah.
And it was a little thing I made right before I started at Thoughtbot, because I wanted to just build a thing that I could ship in like my 2 weeks of downtime between jobs. And I'm a big cigar fan, and I got tired of like having to call cigar stores to see if they carried the brands that I wanted.
Yeah.
And none of them put it online. So it's a little crowdsource thing. And it geofences in the background and sort of, I hate saying it tracks your location in the background, because that sounds really scary. But basically, it tracks your location in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're at a cigar store, and you've been there for long enough that I'm sufficiently convinced that you're sitting there.
Right, you're really there.
It sends you at a maximum of once every 3 days, it sends you a push notification saying, hey, does this store that you're currently at carry this single cigar, yes or no?
Got it.
And the list is just populated by things people have searched for.
Right.
It was pretty simple. But what I wanted was, in terms of browsing the results, when you search for a cigar, and we show you a little map, and then we also have the list version of that map. And on the list, I want it to be... I think we show the list, and then you can tap it to get the map view. But I want it to be separated into the 3 sections, carried, not carried, unknown.
Yeah.
And iOS, that has the 3 styles of lists. There's the short, the long, and the with the header.
Gotcha.
And so on Android, it was like a medium-high amount of code just to even get the little headers, because now all of a sudden, right, I was now responsible for, okay, so I have 2 types of views that are going to be in this list.
Yep.
And writing all the code for like, okay, so if it's the header type, do whatever, and if it's the item type, do this other thing and make sure I have the right classes there. So it was like, it wasn't crazy bad, but it was a moderate amount of boilerplate.
Yep.
But what came with that was a lot of control, and I had a very specific design for the application, and so it was very easy to implement that design. And then on iOS, it was very easy to, like, get the segmented list.
Yep.
But then when I tried to implement the actual design and customize specifically the little header portion.
Yeah.
The overwhelming majority of code in that application is just for that purpose.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, and that sort of, like, is the crux of the difference between the two.
Yeah.
On Android, everything's just a little bit harder.
Right.
But you have a lot of control. And then on iOS, like, if you want to do things the way Apple wants you to do them, it's a little bit easier. But as soon as you need to step 1 foot outside of there, like, you're re-implementing the world from scratch.
Yeah. I always kind of describe the difference by saying that on Android, everything is math-based. So Android will always return you some number value, either, like, if it's a direction that you're scrolling in or where you are on a list, it's always a number value. Whereas on iOS, it feels like they've tried to help you by being like, oh, you're scrolling up, we're going to return you some value that means up. I know what up means. But what it means, though, is that when you're like, I want to know how up I'm, you know, at what velocity, or I want to be able to use that information, that becomes a lot more difficult. Whereas on Android, if you just want to know if you're going up, it's a pain. But when you want to start doing something with kind of the velocity or how far up you are, that number becomes really valuable. So customizing is really great, but you definitely have to, I think for junior developers who are just like, I want a simple app that gets a list on a screen, you have to know a lot to get there. But once you're in it, customizing is definitely a lot simpler.
Android definitely did not optimize for adoption, at least on the developer side.
Yeah, definitely not.
Hello World is, Hello World's difficult in mobile in general.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true. I think there are definitely times where I wish that Google kind of had the same crazy, you know, Apple releases something, software once a year and hardware once a year. So they definitely put a lot of thought into what we're releasing, how it all fits together. And it seems like they have a roadmap, like they'll release something this year and then next year it builds on that. And you're like, oh, I see what you're doing. And it feels like at Google, it's like 40 different children, not that they're kids, Google engineers are adults, but it seems like kind of a classroom mentality of like, here's my homework, let's just ship it all.
Right.
And some of it's really great, and a lot of it is, but it definitely doesn't always feel like well thought out or well put together in terms of the whole ecosystem.
Yeah. I don't know. It's always the trade-off, right? Because it's also targeting a much larger market, and a much larger set of use cases, which is difficult.
Yeah, I learned recently there are, I think it's something like 40,000 unique hardware-software combinations of Android running in the world. And they use that as like a braggy statistic, which to me as a developer is like frightening and gives me nightmares.
Well, so that's the thing, right? But everybody, like a lot of people use that as like, and this is why supporting Android is terrible. But it's like as a developer, you unless you're doing something crazy with like 3D rendering, that very rarely matters because other than the differing screen sizes.
Yeah.
Like you have the minimum version that you target, which you target whatever basically everybody's targeting right now, which is... has gotten better about being like not 2.3.
Yeah, very true.
Or not 4.0, because then it went from 2.3 to like, okay, now it's just 4.0 and nothing but 4.0. But right, like the OS has responsive design baked into its core, so differing screen sizes aren't that big of a deal.
Yeah, and the differing screen sizes isn't so much the issue as much as it is, I think, the backwards compatibility. I think when people think of Android now, especially in the development community, think about material design. Material design is actually like not, people still, I think, traditionally target 16. That gets you like 70% of users. I think
that's 4.1, right?
4.1 or 4.3. Yeah. Okay. Whereas M is 19.
Right.
So
for reference, just 16 was what I was targeting like 2 years ago when I was at Thoughtbot doing Android. So that hasn't,
just
so people know how rarely that number moves if they don't do Android.
Yeah.
And it was 11 for the longest time.
Yeah, I think 16 is going to, because 16 is KitKat, and it's kind of where we're going to live for.
Yeah, okay, so that's 4.3. That's what that was what it was back then.
Yeah, so it's still there. And so I think there are just so many things in terms of views that get added, and, you know, Recycler View is now its own library, so you kind of add that separately.
Well, because everything goes into what's it called?
Support Android library. Support? Yeah.
Yeah.
But it does make it like very frustrating when you want to do something that as a developer, you're like, this was 3 years old and I'm still having to like go have workarounds to be like, please show this shadow, please elevate this.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, has anybody, right? Cause it's been 2 years at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Is it actually like there's still data to show that like in the US, there's a significant number of users on 4.3?
I think the Google numbers, it's still...
Well, but the Google numbers don't partition by country.
Oh, good point. I'm not sure. You'd have to look at something like App Annie or one of those kind of platforms.
Okay, right. Well, because back whenever it was pushing for let's switch to 4.0 and greater and let's stop supporting 2.3, the big argument for anybody supporting 2.3 was like, well, if you go to dashboard.android.com, it still shows that there's a decent number of people. But if you actually looked at any usage numbers from any real application, everybody was on 4.1 or greater. And the overwhelming majority of the 2.3 people were India or China, which, like, not to discount those users, but just if you're a US-based startup, you're probably not actually targeting that market unless you're a social network.
Yeah, and I think the other issue is devices. So, like, Nougat is only available on Nexus right now. I think Samsung's obviously the other major popular Android device. A lot of Samsung devices don't run Lollipop yet. They're not on M. So, like, that makes it harder to drop support for a lot of these older versions.
Well, and it's an issue because, like, it means, right? So, M, I just remember as sort of a functional person. Functional programming tends to produce a lot of garbage. Yep. Garbage collector pre-M is garbage.
Yep.
Like, you need to care about allocations. That, like, object pools are a thing people do on Android, which is weird. Because it's considered, in the general Java world, right?
Yeah.
The object pools are considered to be a general, an anti-pattern. Because it's basically saying, like, oh, yeah, you think you can do garbage collection better than the garbage collector, right?
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Sure. No, you can't.
No.
On Android pre-M, yes, you can.
Yep.
For Ruby listeners out there, it's Ruby 1.8's garbage collector, but slightly worse. It's just a very naive stop the world mark and sweep garbage collector. And Java puts a lot more things in object space than Ruby does. So there's a lot more that it just has to traverse in general. Anyways, yeah. Avoiding going into technical rants on that. So one of the things I've always just loved, because I'm not really an Android developer.
Right.
I say not really. I'm not an Android developer. I just sort of play one on TV sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I've always enjoyed, just from the outside looking in, that I can see stack traces when I'm submitting a bug report.
Yeah.
And I had an interesting one that happened on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
It was Tuesday. So Monday, I came back from lunch. Because
mm-hmm.
So I have a scooter that I use, because I don't walk terribly well, because my back gave out a number of years ago. And I had been having issues with the building that I work in recently, so I've been working from home a lot. But anyway, so I went into the office, and I brought my scooter with me, and I came back from lunch, and there's a Slack DM from a person who I don't think I'd ever spoken to before. It's just like, hey, your scooter wouldn't happen to have a Wi-Fi network on it, would it? I'm like, yeah, it does. Why? You should jump in the security Slack channel. And people had been trying to track down this rogue Wi-Fi network.
Oh, my God.
Because the thing was, like, so I renamed it when I first got this, because I thought it was hilariously silly that this thing had a Wi-Fi network. It was only there for a mobile app that was going to be coming someday, but the mobile app wasn't out. And so I did a lot of pact sniffing, because it just communicates over a JSON API to – the thing is running PHP under the hood, which is scary.
Yeah.
But I did a lot of pact sniffing and tried to reverse engineer the live API. I figured out the way to rename the wireless network to "They See Me Rollin', They Hatin'."
Oh, my God.
And apparently, so A, it was that we didn't know where this Wi-Fi network was coming from.
Right.
And then B, apparently, because it had the word Hatin' in it, one of the directors was worried that it might be seen as racist.
Oh, my God.
Which, and then that turned into a whole other thing. But, like, I've been having issues with people in general. So I just wanted to, like, I've been trying to keep my head down.
Yeah.
So, you know, I pulled out the battery because that was the only way I could think of to get the thing off.
Yeah,
and I figured
it's always
I'd deal
the answer.
With it. Anyway, so that night, my phone updates to Nougat.
Uh-huh.
And the next morning, I'm driving to work.
Mm-hmm.
I plug the battery into my thing in the car. My wife and I work at the same company, so she drives, and I had pulled down the latest version of the app, which I haven't used in a while, but I know definitely, like, worked on the last version of Android.
Right.
And I was like, okay, let me see if maybe somewhere in this app I can just change the network name.
Right.
And the app crashed on boot.
Oh.
Repeatedly.
Yeah.
And I went and I looked at the stack trace, and it was a network on main thread exception.
Oh. That's heartbreaking.
So apparently, because, like, screw async task, right?
Yeah.
They were relying on, like, probably some view light or fragment lifecycle method or something. They were probably relying on, like, some specific place being off the main thread that's now on the main thread in Nougat.
Yeah.
And, oh, now your app crashes on boot.
Oh, my God. That's always so heartbreaking after you get an update and, like, you go to use an app and you notice that something is wrong or something is janky. And it's like, as a developer, like, my heart just breaks because I'm like, that could have happened to any of us at any time. And, you know, there's some, like, product manager somewhere, like, squealing when they find out about it, like, screaming at this developer. So,
yeah, on the other hand,
yeah, doing network calls on the main thread, never acceptable.
If like, there's a very straightforward way to do network IO.
Yep.
That's if an update is causing you to get network on main thread exception, like,
yep. Yeah.
You did that to yourself, friend.
Yeah, I think it's really common. So there's this library called RxJava, which just gives you kind of reactive functional programming in Java. And RxJava is a really, I think, a very popular way for people now to kind of handle networking. The problem is if you don't, so you make a network call via an observable, which is just a stream. And when you get the results back, you have to basically say, please fetch the results on this stream and then return me the results on, or fetch the results on this thread and return me the results on this thread. And I
right.
think it's very common for newbie RxJava users to not thread that properly. And so then you do end up with a lot of network on main thread exceptions, but you're like, but I thought RX was supposed to be asynchronous. And it's like, it can be, but you still have to know how to do that.
On the bright side, though, there, right? At least you're consistently always going to be getting network on main thread exceptions.
Yes.
And in case it wasn't clear, network on main thread exception, Android will unconditionally raise an exception if you try to do network I/O on the main thread, because, like, mobile has limited CPU cycles, and mm-hmm. you should never be doing blocking I/O on the main thread, because that's a terrible user experience.
Yes.
And other things that we should just define. RX is sort of it's called reactive functional programming, and it's style of programming. A stream is just an asynchronous list, if anybody's unfamiliar with those terms.
Oh, yeah. I have a meme that I always send around. It's like a dog meditating, and it says, everything is a stream.
You can represent everything as a stream if you really want to.
Exactly. That's, I think, the, like, uber crazy kind of RX motto.
Okay. Well, so on the uber crazy RX motto, because you've reviewed my older Android code from when I was on my functional programming reactive programming kit.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming you saw the place where I was, like, representing a lot of UI code as reductions of streams.
I don't remember that, but I believe that you did that.
Well, so Marshall Codex was this project, which you guys can go check out, marshallcodex.com. It's great. It's really cool, and the clients are great. What they did was they had the grandmasters of various schools of martial arts come into a motion capture studio, and then at Thoughtbot, I had built a way to sort of view annotated lessons around that, which allows you to view what they're doing with precision that you wouldn't be able to get from angles that are abnormal.
Yep.
And if you have somebody trying to demonstrate, like, and here's how you do this punch, and I'm going really slowly, and see, you do this thing with your elbow, but they're no longer doing the right thing with their elbow because they're trying to slow it down. And so because of the motion capture technology, you're able to slow it down and see it at a detail that you wouldn't have been able to.
Yeah, and move the camera around to kind of see it from different angles as well.
Yeah, and so you can get it from, like, a sky view or underneath, and so it was really cool. And so we originally built just the web app, and then we had done the Android app. And the Android app was, like, when the project stopped, it was, like, 80% complete. All of the engine stuff was built out. It was, at that point, it was all just the storefront stuff that was unfinished.
Yeah.
But so we had built it in Scala, which, like, now that Scala has really fallen by the wayside, it's an even more of an obviously bad call.
Yeah.
But also, just given that we knew we were going to do a iOS version as well, like, obviously now, looking back on it, because hindsight is 2020, obviously we should have done all of the engine stuff in C.
Yeah.
Like, there's just no good reason for us to have not done that. But there was some interesting stuff that we were able to do on the view side. And so one of the things that we did was, the camera controls, which, like, listeners, you should go to marshallcodex.com. It's free, and you can check out some stuff. So it will make more sense, because the click and drag, it's similar. So, like, we wanted to have it be, so the camera is sort of like you click and drag to rotate around a sphere, and we wanted to do a similar thing with swiping. And so what we sort of did was I started grabbing all of the touch events, and basically took every pair and started representing them as a stream of swiping in a given direction. And then all the various camera motions got just represented as reductions on that stream.
Yeah.
And then eventually on the main thread, we'd be like, okay, and then whenever we get a new event on this stream that is the result of all of these different reductions, like, we move the camera up, and then we dirty the OpenGL context, and we re-render everything. It was kind of cool, but it's also one of those things where it's like, boy, if you're not, like, super into FRP...
And you came and saw this, you'd be like, what is happening?
Right. And I also am aware that anybody who just does normal Android who comes and is like, this is in Scala, is going to think I'm a complete insane person, which is not an unreasonable assessment.
Yeah. Yeah, you would actually, there's a library called RX Bindings, which sounds like would be right up your alley, but takes basically the wrapper around all the traditional, and Android everything is a callback, but it basically wraps all those callbacks into streams. So for text events or view events or anything like that. So I think that's becoming a lot more popular, and I think people who use RX at least would a lot more easily recognize that concept and that sort of approach.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. Like, Reactive Cocoa is pretty popular on the iOS side of things.
Yeah, definitely. I think RX Swift, I haven't played with it myself yet, but I don't know if people like it as much, or given Swift, if people feel they don't need it anymore.
Right.
So I don't know how that is going. Because I know that I think just like Java, like with Objective-C, anything that would make it a little bit more functional and modernized was well received. But given that right. Swift and Kotlin kind of solve a lot of those issues, I don't know if people still feel that that's necessary.
Well, I feel like we would need to have Gordon on here to really answer that.
Yes.
Cool. Well, we've been going for almost an hour, so I think maybe we should wrap it up.
Cool.
Cool. Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/78.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are greatly appreciated.
If you have feedback on this episode or any other, you can leave a review on bikeshed.fm, email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm.
Thank you so much, and we'll see you all next week.